Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, today's show doesn't actually have a specific Greatest Briton, but it deals with the Great Britons and their attempts to prevent the Romans from invading Britain. And this actually took place in between the Julian invasions by Julius Caesar and the later Claudian invasions. So today's episode deals with that period of time between Caswallon defeating Caesar and Caractacus fighting against the Romans once again. And of course, my co-host for the show is, of course, Max Musson from Western Spring. Shall we get on to the Romans and the Britons now then, Max? Shall we have
okay,
a look at that?
Let's do that.
Yeah, well, last week we heard all about Caswallon and how he sent Julius Caesar packing. And there was actually about 100 years between that incident and the next invasion of the Romans. But there were quite a few interesting things that happened over that time, during that 100 years. So I've got some more from Reverend R.W. Morgan's book here that we can look at. And it's basically Britain between Caswallon and Caractacus. And we've already done an episode on Caractacus and his interactions with the Romans. So this will carry us through from Caswallon right the way up to Caractacus. And if people are listening to a repeat of this, then they can listen to the Caractacus episode after this, and it should continue straight on. Well, contrasted with the overwhelming and permanent success of the Norman invasion, affected by a comparatively barbarian conqueror and forces, the double defeat of the Julian invasions may even at this remote period be dwelt upon with honourable pride by the descendants of the gallant ancestors who achieved it. For 97 years, no Roman again ventured to plant a hostile foot on our island, and when the Roman eagle under Claudius once more expanded its wings to the stormy winds of Britain, it was when no other unconquered enemy met its eye from the Euphrates to Gibraltar, and the empire it symbolised had leisure to turn the whole of its vast forces against the sole free people of the West. Caswallon, after the Julian invasion, reigned for 7 years over Britain and its dependencies, and Augustus Caesar succeeded Julius at Rome in BC 30. So I'll just stop there, because, I mean, that makes it clear that whatever the Romans said about it, no Roman soldier was left behind on British soil. No tribute was handed over. There are no hostages that are recorded. So it was twice that the Britons really defeated the Romans, and it wasn't until they were actually able to turn the whole of the forces of the continent against Britain that they actually ventured to try and take us on once again. And that was a 100 years later. And that last attack they made, they had the whole of France with them as well. And this really shows you that how strong Britain was and how important Britain was. You know, we were the center, I would guess, of the barbarian world being outside of Rome. There really wasn't much going on in Germany at this time, but in Britain we had these tin mines, as we said, that provided the resources for the Bronze Age, basically, throughout the rest of the world. And we were undefeated. We sent the Romans packing. And it's also interesting how he compares that with the Norman invasion as well, when we lost. I mean, we were able to defeat the Romans twice, but we lost to the Normans a thousand years later. Do you want to comment on this introduction, Max?
Well, it's also interesting how it compares with Brexit, really, where we are the only country that has, having become part of the European Union, has now detached ourselves from, or is in the process of detaching ourselves from the European Union. And it shows, well, this history shows the long tradition there has been in these British islands for us to regard ourselves as free and independent from the rest of Europe. And it shows how long the history is during which the European mainland and various regimes on the European mainland have attempted to crush the defiance and the independence of the people of the British Isles.
Yeah, we have a long, very long history of being independent. Well, many years elapsed before the resources of the empire sufficiently recovered themselves to enable Augustus to turn his attention to Britain. Ambassadors were then sent demanding that the three reguli of the Coronaiad, the Dumno, Bellaunus, and Gerneian, who had appealed to the Protectorate of Rome, to which their state had, in the time of Julius, been admitted, should be restored to their confiscated possessions, which had been taken for the redress of certain alleged grievances. So when Arvirui went to Rome and said that he wanted to be part of the Protectorate, that was still in place at this time. And these were the tribes that were part of this protectorate, the Coronaiad, the Dumno, Bellaunus, and Gerneian. So they were actually appealing to Rome to sort out their problems. And we mentioned this in the last episode as well, that this was used as an excuse for Rome to go in somewhere to sort out the problems, and then they would take the place over. Exactly yes. The same principle we see today, don't we, with the UN, what they try to do.
Yep.
And they're trying to do with Belarus at the moment as well. Well, Cymbeline, or Cymbeline, the son of Tenuantius and the grand-nephew of Caswallon, had succeeded his father on the British throne. Tenuantius, a monarch distinguished for the justice of his administration and the moderation of his views, had lived on terms of amity with Rome. His son Cymbeline had been educated by Augustus in his own palace and had subsequently served in the German campaigns under Caesar Germanicus. He received the ambassadors with due courtesy, but peremptorily rejected the interference of a foreign potentate in the affairs of Britain. Again, this is interesting because it shows we weren't in a state of bad affairs with the Romans, and we actually had a palace in Rome. And our king's sons were educated in Rome. I think this continued right up to Saxon times, didn't it? Because King Alfred was educated at Rome for some time, or he actually spent some time at Rome there. And once again, we see that the British had distinguished themselves in wars. We see that Cymbeline had subsequently served in the German campaigns under Caesar Germanicus, because we were well known for being very strong warriors as well. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I think that's all pretty self-explanatory, to be quite honest. And again, I'd heartily concur with the remarks that you've made and the conclusions that you've drawn.
Well, Augustus immediately ordered one half of the disposable force of the empire to be moved to the Gallic harbours on the Channel. Of these, he designed to take the command in person. The other half were sent under Aelius Gallus against the Parthians, the only independent nation in the east, as were the Britons in the west. The subjugation of these two nations would render the whole of the old world a Roman provincia, or conquered land, entitling Augustus, in the opinion of the literary flatterers who crowded his court, to be considered, even before his death, an apotheosis, a present god on earth. And that's a quote from Horace. The Parthians accepted the Roman terms and surrendered the standards they had captured some years earlier on the field of Shazi, or Haran, where Crassus had fallen. The invasion of Britain, however, was a more serious enterprise. Cymbeline had concentrated his forces at Dover, with the southern coast to the Land's End peninsula guarded by his brother Lear. The British fleet, as we learn from the oration of Boadicea in Dion Cassius, swept the Channel. The preparations of Augustus were tardily urged and indicated that pride had already superseded wisdom. His campaigns had never actually been conducted in person, and where the genius of Julius had been baffled, inferior skill was likely to incur nothing but disgrace. A reverse, as Horace had the courage to warn him in his Ode 35, would be followed by a rising of the oligarchic faction at home. So the concern here was that if he lost, he would lose everything. And he had just won against the Parthians without actually having to use any of his forces. Do you want to comment on this, on the Parthians or any of that, Max?
Well, just really to reemphasise the importance of us having the channel between us and the European mainland, the importance that's had throughout our history in providing us with an extra element of defence that's prevented us from being invaded other than by the most determined invaders.
I think it's interesting the way they talk about the fleet that swept the channel as well, that must have been a hell of a lot of boats that they actually had, a lot of vessels. And that was coming from Boadicea's speech. So you can see where the author of this is getting his quotes from all over the place to build up this picture of what was going on, because a lot of it was taken from this Roman propaganda. Well, Cymbeline was not slow to take advantage of this reluctancy. An interview with the imperial friend and host of his youth was solicited, and the result was a triumph of British diplomacy, a much rarer species of success in all eras of our history than that of British arms. Not only was the claim of a protectorate over the Corinthiad and with it the demand of a tribute from that wealthy tribe abandoned, but the heavy duties previously levied on the introduction of British goods to the continent were reduced to a very light tariff, as we're told by Strabo. Friendly relations were restored. British nobles again took up their residence at Rome and were to be seen dedicating their offerings at the shrines of the capital. The glory of seeing the unconquered Britain descend the Sacrovia in chains, that's another Horace quote, was deferred for another generation. Cymbeline, after a brilliant reign of 35 years, was succeeded by his eldest son, Guiderius, his younger son, Arviragus, receiving the dukedom of Cornwall. Caradoc, the son of Bran, the son of Lear, the brother of Cymbeline, succeeded at the same time by the resignation of his father to the princedom of Cambria, which is Wales. His residence was on the site of the present Dunraven Castle, in the centre of his maternal estates in Siluria. And I just wanted to point out here this bit about diplomacy and the point that he makes here, that succeeding in diplomacy is a much rarer species of success in all eras of our history than that of British arms. So he's obviously proud of the fact that, you know, we defeated a lot of countries, but we've never been that good on diplomacy. And also this bit about the taxes that have been put on the British goods once they got to the continent. Again, that shows that things were very similar back then to how they are today, because that's what all the talk about now is what are the taxes going to be once we've left the European Union? What are the tariffs going to be? How is the trade going to be? And if
British diplomacy is such a rare species of success in all eras of our history, it that doesn't bode well for the outcome of the current negotiations that are taking place with regard to European Union, and perhaps rather suggests that we're rather than have a negotiated settlement with them, there will be what will amount to a UDI, unilateral declaration of independence on the part of the British government, with perhaps a Cod War over the fishing rights in the North Sea, and we may see history kind of repeating itself.
It is interesting, isn't it? There's the same thing going on back then, the same tactics going on with taxes on trade. Well, then we move on to the birth of Christ and how that affected Britain. The Holy Nativity of our blessed Lord and Saviour took place at Bethlehem in the 13th year of the reign of Cymbeline, with the crucifixion in the 11th year of Guiderius and the 17th year of Tiberius Caesar, who succeeded Augustus on AD 14. Tiberius reigned for 23 years. In the 19th year of his reign occurred the first persecution of the Church of Christ by Paul of Tarsus, a young man with a combination of extraordinary qualifications that pointed him out to the Jewish Sanhedrin as the champion of their cause against the religion of the crucified. The persecution raged with great fury, and for a time completely scattered the whole church, with the apostles alone excepted from the mother city of Jerusalem. And this is a period that most Christians don't really think about. What happened to these Christians at this time, at this first persecution? Where did they actually go to? And you think, well, this is a part of Rome. Judea is a part of Rome, and they're being persecuted within the Roman Empire. So where are they likely to go? Were they likely to go outside the Roman Empire? Which means they would have been likely to go to Britain. This is another part of our history that doesn't really get talked about a lot. And then we come to Joseph of Arimathea, who we have lots of legends telling us that he visited Cornwall, and there's even songs about it. Joseph was a tin merchant. continuing with the quotes here, a great propagation of the gospel had taken place after the day of Pentecost. Devout men of every nation under heaven carried intelligence of the miraculous descent of the Holy Spirit and of the preaching of the new faith, known then simply as the way of God, to their respective countries. The Pauline persecution, by dispersing the Judean Christians, also caused a second great propagation. Amongst others who were thus driven to foreign lands was Joseph of Arimathea. He, with Mary Magdalene, Lazarus, against whom the Jews cherished an inextinguishable hatred, his two sisters Mary and Martha, and with their handmaiden Mercilla, were carried out to sea and consigned in a vessel without oars or sails to the mercy of the elements. After dreadful sufferings, they were cast ashore near Marseille in the south of France. And the handmaiden there, Mercilla, she's still worshipped by the gypsies to this day. They have like an idol of Mercilla that they take into the sea in Marseille, and they honour her. I think she's the patron saint of gypsies. There's lots of evidence to show that this actually happened, and lots of venerations in Marseille to do with this. But from Marseille, Joseph found means to communicate with his family and friends in Palestine. 40 of them, 11 being his own relatives, joined him, with Philip the Apostle coming with them. After preaching the gospel for 12 months in Gaul, Joseph and his fraternity were invited by some eminent British Druids who had been amongst his hearers to Britain. They were well received by Arviragus and placed under the protection of one of the three great Druidic circles of the kingdom in Innis Avalon. Here they laid the foundations of the first Christian church on record, 60 feet in length and 26 in breadth, building it in the Gallic fashion of timber pillars connected by double tissues of strong wickerwork. This church became the nucleus of a succession of magnificent edifices erected over its uninspiring roof. And I'll just stop there, and we'll go into the Glastonbury Church in a minute. Have you got any comments to make on this, Max, this early dispersion of Christianity here? Had you heard of these legends before, with the connections to Britain?
No, I hadn't, actually. It's interesting, but one of the things that has been impressed upon me as we've been going through these histories is the degree of mobility of people, necessarily of every person, necessarily of perhaps people who would be peasants or who are from the poorer lower classes, but certainly amongst people who were leaders and who were in the military, etc. The degree of mobility where people would go and fight wars in very far-flung places. And so when people talk about the Crusades, and very often people think, what on earth were we doing going all the way to Palestine in order to pursue the Crusades? That was just part of this whole approach on the part of people of substance, that they did travel and did trade all over Europe. And so it's not a matter that Europe has throughout history been composed of lots of little hermetically sealed nations that don't have any dealings with other nations other than those that they've got a direct border with. It's a matter that people from all of the nations of Europe, people of substance, as I say, were prone throughout history to travel to the other more far-flung parts of Europe.
It's like we were just as connected then as we were now. I mean, you got people coming from right over the other side of the Mediterranean. We had people coming from North Africa. We had the King of Africa came to Britain, according to the Chronicles, and that was the King of the Vandals. And he settled here with some Vandals, and they use that today to try and pretend that the King of Africa was a Negro. And he wasn't. It was the Vandals, because the Romans had North Africa. The sub-Saharan Negroes didn't actually make their way up through the Sahara. That's why they were called sub-Saharan Negroes. So when you hear this talk of Africans being in Britain, they were white Africans. They were Romans, or they were Vandals. I think the Goths were there for a while as well in North Africa.
Carthaginians,
yeah.
Carthaginians. The Phoenicians also had colonies along the north coast of Africa.
And the Phoenicians were over here with the tin mines as well, and picking the tin up. We got Greek records saying they saw the Phoenician ships picking up the tin from St. Michael's Mount in Cornwall and then taking it back. If you think we had horse and cart, horse and chariot as well, and we had the roads that the Romans had built on the continent, plus all the, obviously the roads that we had in Britain, I mean, you're probably a little bit slower to get to these places, but it's certainly feasible. And we see here that the British nobles had, they had dwellings in Rome, they had buildings in Rome that they lived in as well as in Britain. I guess they probably went there for the winter time, I should imagine, although it was a little bit warmer here back then. Going back to Glastonbury, it passed for some generations by no other name than the Home of God, the House of God, the Secret of God. And subsequently, it was known as the Mother of Churches, the Glory of Britain, the Resting Place of the Apostles. And that's a reference to Joseph of Arimathea, who is supposedly buried there. The island on which it was built, either from the clearness of the springs in which it abounded, or because Joseph was said to have brought with him the crystal vessel in which St. John and himself received the blood and water, which flowed at the piercing of the centurion Longinus's spear on the cross, from the heart of the Saviour, was called Inniswidrin, the Crystal Isle, translated by the Saxons in after times to Glaston and Glastonbury. And there are some documents that point to it actually being in Wales rather than in Glastonbury. But it certainly happened, but whether it was in the place that we know as Glastonbury today or not, we don't know. But this did certainly happen, and the first church was in Britain. The mother of all churches was Glastonbury, the Domus Dei. It is satisfactory to add the course of history for this mother church of Britain, which served as church, college, and abbacy. As it was the longest, so also was it the most beneficent of all the great ecclesiastical establishments of Christendom. Its estates held in trusteeship for and ever devoted to the sustentation and employment of the poor and the encouragement of learning were confiscated in the time of Henry VI, amidst the general regret and indignation of the kingdom. They now yield rentals exceeding £300,000 per annum. And I think that might have been Henry VIII. Was it Henry VIII for the Reformation or Henry VI? Do you know, Max? I think it was the 8th.
I couldn't say off the top of my head, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I think it was the 8th, and that's a misprint there. The gentle, unobtrusive character of the highborn decurio, the noblesse decurio, as Joseph is termed in the British records, admirably won the esteem of Arviragus and the warlike population of his western dominions, and prepared the way for the future extension of Christianity in the island. Among his converts were Gladys, the sister of Arviragus, and Guiderius, who subsequently, under her Roman designation of Pomponia Grecina, married Aulus Plotius, the Roman commander, and Egra, sister of Caractacus and wife of Salog, lord of Carsalog, Salisbury, the first female saint in Britain. Among the missionaries of the gospel educated and sent forth by Joseph at Avalon were St. Beatus, or Gwynnifed, and St. Mansuetus, or Mungu. Beatus was born of noble parentage in Britain and passed over to the continent and founded the Helvetian Church in Switzerland. He began his mission by disposing of all his property for the redemption of Helvetian prisoners of war. He fixed his habitation at Undersevern near the Lake of Thun, where his church and cell remain objects of profound veneration. He died in AD 96. Mansuetus, born in Ireland before converting in Britain, preached the gospel with St. Clement in Gaul. He founded the Church of Lorraine. From this province, he extended his evangelical labours to Illyria and finally suffered martyrdom at Toul in AD 110. Thus, before an acre of British soil was incorporated within the empire of pagan Rome, Britain had not only received the gospel, but had also been the blessed instrument of its propagation to nations on the continent. So Christianity actually travelled to Britain and then to Switzerland before 100 AD. The church was started in Switzerland. This history is just not known by people, how far back this history goes, and the fact that it was brought over here by the Druids, basically. There was no animosity between the Druids and the Christians, and there are quite a few links between Druidry and early Christianity. But that's it for the Christian stuff. Do you want to comment on that at all, Max?
The thing that's occurred to me as we've been talking through this is the vast expanse of the Roman Empire and how far flung the like opposite ends of the empire are, were from each other, and the realization that the maximum extent of the Roman Empire was dictated by the modes of transport of those days. And so in terms of transporting large quantities of either of people or large quantities of materials for trade, then that sort of trade took place and that transport took place at sea. And so people would sail to various places. But also another limitation on the Roman Empire was its inability to penetrate into central and eastern parts of Europe, and then also into Russia, other than along the coasts. And that was because, obviously, penetrating deeply inland, as far as the continent of Europe was concerned, where it connects with Asia, the transport would have had to have been by cart and by horse, which would have limited the ability to communicate along those through those tracts of land. And and I'm reminded of the one of the things that Ben Klassen, I don't know whether you're aware of his writings, he's the author of a book called Nature's Eternal Religion, but one of the things he makes a great play upon there is that if only the Romans had realized the potency of the little steam engine that was created by an inventor called Hero, who lived in Alexandria during the Roman Empire, who created a little steam engine that was used to amuse children, and it was just regarded as a toy. But had they realized, as Robert Louis Stevenson did many centuries later, the power of steam locomotives and the what steam locomotives would have opened up for them, then the Roman Empire could have become massively greater, and they could have penetrated into Eastern Europe and also Central Asia and perhaps become a much greater empire than they actually did.
That's incredible. I didn't know they had they actually had a steam engine all the way back then. I guess to a time just wasn't quite right for it. But it shows you they were exactly the same people as us back then, with the same IQ, just as inventive. They probably had, you know, they had the same ideas of society that we have now. They were probably far more courteous and chivalrous back then, with a much greater sense of morality, and probably had, the way that we read, they had books, they had plays, very, very similar to today, a lot more similar than we give them credit for, I think. Well, in AD 37, Tiberius was succeeded by Caius Caligula. The year was marked by the births of Nero, Josephus the historian, and Julius Agricola, the last destined to enact an important part in the future wars of Britain. The tranquility pervading the Roman Empire induced Caligula to renew the attempts at a conquest which the first and second Caesars had either failed to achieve or wisely bequeathed to their successors. The character, however, of this emperor, compounded of mania and vice, left a memorable stamp of ridicule upon the whole expedition. The armies of Gaul and the Rhine rendezvoused at Boulogne, where a Roman flotilla collected from Spain was moored, ostensibly prepared to embark the troops in the Seine. The appearance, however, of a British fleet under Arviragus disconcerted and put an abrupt end to this enterprise, if indeed it was ever seriously meditated. Caligula, who felt a morbid delight in burlesquing the most momentous measures of state and scandalizing the world by the maddest acts of imperial caprice, held a grand review of his splendid expeditionary force on the sands at Boulogne. At its termination, mounting the tribunal, he expounded on the glory already encircling his brow as one who had led his troops like Bacchus, Hercules, and Sesostris to the confines of the earth surrounding ocean. He asked if such renown ought to be jeopardized by an armed exploration of an island which nature itself had removed beyond the power and jurisdiction of the gods of Rome, and which the campaigns of the deified Caesar himself had only succeeded in pointing out to the wonder of the continental world. "Let us, my fellow soldiers," he concluded, adopting the well-known phrase of the great Julius, "leave these Britons unmolested. To war beyond the bounds of nature is not courage, but impiety. Let us rather load ourselves with the bloodless spoils of the Atlantic Ocean, which the same beneficent goddess of nature presents on these sands so lavishly at our feet. Follow the example of your emperor. Behold," he added, suiting the action to his words, "I wreath for laurel this garland of green seaweed around my immortal brow, and for spoiler opima I fill my helm with these smooth and brilliant shells. Decorated with these, we will return to Rome, and instead of a British king, Neptune, the god of the ocean himself, shall follow a captive to the capital behind our triumphal car. To each of you, my fellow soldiers, in this arduous enterprise, I promise the gratuity of a year's extra pay in just acknowledgement of your services and fidelity to your emperor." This singular harangue, which it is difficult to regard in any light other than the practical sarcasm of an absolute despot whose gloomy insanity, like that of Paul's of Russia, was occasionally illuminated by disordered flashes of wit on the scarcely less insane ambition and egotism of the whole race of conquerors, was received with thunders of acclamation. The projected expedition had been from the first viewed with extreme distaste by the soldiers in general, and despite the stern indignation openly manifested and expressed by their officers, they did not hesitate to give full vent to their satisfaction, and with military jests and peals of laughter, imitated the example of their imperial master. Of all trials to the faith of a Christian in the superintending providence of God, the spectacle so constantly meeting our view in history, of the welfare of nations being placed at the mercy of idiots and of the vilest characters in high places, is the most trying. It is also perhaps the surest moral evidence we possess of the certainty of a future state of compensation and retribution. The British fleet gazed with astonishment on the bronzed and mail-clad veterans of the Empire disporting themselves with the hilarity of children in the childish amusement of gathering shells on the seashore. The explanation of so curious an illustration of the workings of despotism was scarcely less perplexing, but supplied, when comprehended, an inexhaustible topic of social merriment and bardic satire to the whole island. The camp was broken up, and Caligula entered Rome in triumphal procession with his army on his birthday, August the 31st, AD 40. He was assassinated the following year, in the 29th year of his age, January the 24th, and succeeded by Claudius, who was then in his 50th year. So we have quite a scene there that's conjured up for us of this total fool of a Caesar that thought that he was going to invade Britain, and at the last minute he tells them to just pick up seashells and seaweed and decorate themselves in that. What a nutcase. Have you heard of him before, Caligula?
Well, I have heard of Caligula before. I hadn't heard that particular... heard of that particular incident, but perhaps he'll go down in history as the, or perhaps perhaps he'll go down in history as the Michel Barnier of his time, basically.
And that's the second invasion that we've managed to put off, basically, without actually fighting. We had the diplomatic way that we put off the last one, and this time he just realized that he was actually being very foolish. I mean, the fear of invading Britain must have been very, very strong after the two Julian invasions. The year AD 42 was distinguished by the incorporation of the whole of North Africa into the Roman Empire by the arms of Suetonius Paulinus and Cneius Ovidius Geta. So I guess he must have been a Goth, Geta, at the surname there. In July, a British embassy arrived from Guiderius at Rome, complaining of encouragement given by the Roman court to the intrigues of Beric and Adminius, two princes of the Brigantes and Corritani, who had been banished from Britain for treasonable practices, being detected in correspondence with Caligula during the late menaced invasion. The embassy returned not only with its business unfinished, but announcing the determination of Claudius to attempt at all hazards the subjugation of Britain. Whatever estimate we may form of the political capabilities of Claudius himself, it is certain that at no time were the great offices of state filled by men with higher administrative powers. Policy also required that the vast military forces of the empire should be found foreign employment. no danger being so dreaded by a despotism so much as an idle and therefore licentious soldiery. The safety of the throne of the Caesars rested on the allegiance, and the allegiance on the discipline, with the discipline on the honourable employment of the legions against the enemies of Rome. These vital considerations formed and dictated the foreign policy of the imperial court, and colourable pretexts were never wanting for carrying out such a policy against independent states. So now we see Rome is at its greatest strength. We see that the Britons are not happy about these two princes, and the embassy that asking to have them back so that we can punish them for their treason. The embassy is sent back and with the message that Claudius is going to invade with the whole might of the Roman Empire now, which includes the whole of North Africa as well. Do you want to make a comment on that, Max?
No, I think it's, as I said before, that's, this history is pretty self-explanatory. You can see the storm clouds brewing, and it's going to be interesting to see how things pan out, or did pan out.
War, in the usual form of the Roman College of Heralds, the Ficiales, was declared by casting a spear towards Britain and by calling upon the gods to withdraw their presence and protection from her. All communication between the two kingdoms was now suspended. A powerful force under Aulus Plotius, one of the most able and unscrupulous of the iron-hearted generals of the empire, was concentrated at the usual rendezvous of Boulogne. The fleet collected for their transportation was too numerous and well-equipped to number, but an unexpected obstacle was to present itself. The army of invasion, on discovering their destination was to be Britain, broke out into mutiny. Appeals to their sacraments or military oaths of obedience and loyalty failed to move them. The lapse of three generations had not extinguished the memory of the Julian campaigns in the imperial armies, the tales of slaughter, of the terrible chariot charges, of the obstinate and sanguinary engagements on the Walmer beach. In the pitched fields and within the camps themselves, these were handed down as embellished in the vivid narratives of tradition and were related in every tent. The various cohorts, to the impassioned addresses of their general, returned a sullen and determined refusal to embark. Hanging up their arms, they exclaimed, "We will march anywhere within the Roman world, but not out of it." The crisis was pregnant with more than one kind of danger. Narcissus, the eunuch, the freedman and favourite minister of Claudius, was immediately dispatched from the court to the scene of the disaffection. Convening the soldiers, Narcissus, whose defects were not those of moral or physical cowardice, mounted the general's tribunal and began an oration to them. It was the first time a eunuch had ventured to address a Roman army. Stupefaction for a time kept the legions dumb, but when he explained he would himself be their leader into Britain, tears of shame burst down their cheeks, and a universal shout of indignation arose from the camp that a eunuch should dare to offer to lead men. The reaction was complete. Surrounding the tent of Plotius, the troops implored him to lead them to Britain or wherever he would will them. The general took instant advantage of this change of temper, and embarking them into three divisions, landed 2 days afterwards between Thanet and Richborough. And compare that to today, where we have transsexuals that are held up on a pedestal, and we've even got transsexual not senators but governors in America, and people standing to be elected, and that's been promoted. So again, that's another thing that we had in common with back then. They had they had eunuchs back then. Do you want to add anything, Max?
I think it's a highly amusing story, really, that a man with no balls was sent to basically dress down the Roman army for not exhibiting the balls to invade Britain, which is kind of ironic, really, isn't it?
Shaming them into it, basically. I mean, they're quite entertaining, both those ones, the seashells and Narcissus the eunuch. The Claudian invasion, which commenced here in AD 43 and terminated after a war of 43 years' duration, was waged with fluctuating success and resulted in the final expulsion of the Romans from Britain in AD 86. It was remarkable for the succession of able commanders that it produced on both sides. Britain during this period served the same purpose for Rome as Hindustan has during the last century for Britain. It was a nursery for raising generals and for maintaining the efficiency of her troops. With the exception of the campaigns of Corbulo in Germany, AD 47, and Armenia, AD 58, and of the conquest of Dacia effected in one campaign, AD 86, no other foreign hostilities engaged the attention of the Roman arms. The emperors were at liberty to direct the whole force of the empire against this island alone, a fact which has been carefully ignored by the Roman historians. So it excites no surprise that it should not have been observed by the modern writers either, who can see nothing British in these heroic old times, except through the hostile and distorting medium of a Roman pair of eyes. And that's our answer as to why we don't know this history. Because they tell it, people today just tell it through the Roman eyes, instead of actually looking at it and what was happening. I mean, it's incredible that we defeated Rome three times, and this time it took them 43 years worth of war with the whole of the might of the Roman Empire just to try and take down our little island here before they finally left. Well, that the rest of this story is told in the episode that we did on Caractacus, but that's our interactions with the Romans. Do you want to add any final thoughts on this, Max?
Well, I think it's just inspiring when you see the kind of terror that British soldiers and British fighters caused in the hearts of mainland Europeans as far back as that. And just to reiterate really what I said a bit earlier on, really, which is that it's incredible the length of the tradition that there has been for Britain to be independent of mainland Europe and to be feared by it. And I think that there are many aspects of the current negotiations that are taking place over Brexit where it's obvious that what the European Union fears most is that there will be a truly independent and sovereign Britain on these islands, and in their negotiations over the trade deal that the government's trying to make with the European Union, it's evident that they want to try. They're trying everything they can in order to erode our sovereignty and independence in return for getting that trade deal, basically. And as I say, it's been going on for a long time.
We've got the traitors here today as well, just like the traitors back then that were going to try and become part of the protectorate and that were working with Caligula, the two nobles that had been working with Caligula before he was planning to invade, and we got the same thing today. We got the traitors that were trying to stop Brexit that were working on the side of the European Union, and our trade is far outweighs the trade that we get from the European Union, just as back at this time, our trade, our tin was the most important thing in Europe because there weren't any other tin mines. I mean, they might have found a few small ones, I think, since then, but our tin mines were the largest, and they produced tin for all around the rest of the world. I mean, we were really, really central, really important, and we had a very strong race of warriors here alongside our religion of Druidry, which around at this time it was evolving into Christianity. I think it was about 170 AD when King Lucius pronounced the nation Christian, and all these important things were happening back then. And the way that it's told like this, I think when it's told with a patriotic flavor to it, it's far more likely to get people interested in history. You know, I find it fascinating, I really do, and it's such a shame that it's not taught in this way to children in schools anymore, because it would have been at the time of Reverend R.W. Morgan. In one of the quotes that he makes, he says that all schoolboys know Caractacus's speech off by heart. So this is the way it would have been taught back then. And of course, they can't do that today because that would alienate the other races that are here, and they've got to try and insert foreigners into this somehow. And
stimulate nationalism, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we can't have that. Can't have that. We can't have patriotic youths that want to be the best they can possibly be. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to hear more about our greatest Britons, then tune in to Real Britannia on Mondays, where it features in the second half of that show. Or you can wait until all these separate pieces are edited together into one complete show, like the one you have just heard.